Ave listeners, before we get started, the When in Rome podcast, an erstwhile plucky young companion to this podcast, is now fundraising for the fourth series. This podcast looks at buildings and sites in the Roman Empire, and among sites like the Colosseum, tombs, triumphal arches, I just spent a long stretch looking at the site of Pompeii. Now, unlike the emperors of Rome, When in Rome is assembled in the loving care of my home studio at night, and it relies on public support. So if you'd like to help out and hear more of this podcast, go to Kickstarter and search for When in Rome, and I'll also be putting links on social media. It's currently raised about half its funding, and it could use any support you'd like to give. And with that in mind, here's Emperors of Rome. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University. This is episode CXI, the Equestrian Order. The equites belong to a class of Roman citizen dating back to the time of the Kingdom of Rome. Ranking below the senatorial class, they grew in power and influence, occupying key positions in the government and military. I should at this point mention a rather excellent new book, A History of the Roman Equestrian Order, published by Cambridge University Press. Here's the author, Kaelin Davenport.
There could only be a fixed number of members of the Senate, which was the most prestigious aristocratic group. They generally numbered between 300 and 600 in the Principate, sometimes as much as 900 under Julius Caesar. But membership was quite restricted. So beneath them, the second highest social group, the equites, and they encompassed a wide variety of people from different social backgrounds. They could be officers, they could be administrators, they could be businessmen, they could be tax collectors. The one unifying factor was that they met a basic property qualification, which was 400,000 sesterces in the period of the late Republic and early Empire. And they had been rated as morally fit to undertake the position. Mm. It was a way of giving status and honour to a much wider group of people than the Senate.
And was there somebody whose role it was to evaluate these people to make sure that they fit these criteria?
Yes. So originally it was the censors. So at the beginning of the Roman state, the equites were the cavalry. So they had to be assessed to make sure that they had the necessary property qualification every 5 years during the census, but also that they were good and upright citizens who didn't cavort with prostitutes or actors or things like that. Mm. And in the imperial period, there was eventually a part of the imperial administration designed to assessing their qualifications, but then all appointments were officially made by the emperor.
Okay, so you could in theory lose your equestrian status.
Very much so.
Not even in theory.
No, yes, you could. Yeah. So if you fell on hard times and you no longer had the 400,000 sesterces property qualification, at the next census you could be removed, but you could also be removed for immoral behaviour. Also in the early period, if you weren't physically fit enough. So we hear about Cato the Elder, when he was censor, removing people from the equestrian order because they were too fat, he thought, to ride their horse.
Wow.
And they weren't physically fit enough.
Yeah.
So nice body shaming going on there from Cato the Elder. So yes, you could definitely be removed. If you fought as a gladiator, for example, without imperial permission, you could be removed. If you married a prostitute or married an actress or something like that, there are various sort of moral and physical criteria which you had to fulfill as well.
Okay. And is this an order that was unique to Rome at the time, or is there equivalents in other empires?
The equestrian order itself is unique to Rome, but there's a strong association between cavalry and aristocracy both in Europe, the Near East and the Far East. For example, the Japanese samurai rode on horseback.
Mm.
We often think of them as warriors on their feet, but they also rode on cavalry. It is always in every society the aristocrats who are wealthy enough to afford horses. So, you know, if we go back to the early Iron Age, which is where Rome begins, most people could only fight with swords or other things they're able to equip themselves with. It was the aristocrats who were wealthy enough to, you know, feed, maintain horses, but also have the type of lifestyle which they could exercise and train on horseback, because most people are farmers and they're not going to have that time. So we can see this cavalry riding aristocracy developing throughout Italy, throughout Latium, which is the central area, but also southern areas of Italy, such as Campania. And you find parallels with aristocrats and horse riding in Greece, for example, but then also in medieval Europe as well. We must think of the knights, and they intentionally played on the links with the Roman equites.
Yeah, yeah. So this goes back to the monarchy days of Rome?
Very much so. So we need to distinguish here between the reality of the period and the legends which surrounded it.
Yes.
So there was clearly an early monarchy. We don't know if there are really seven kings of Rome or if Romulus ever really existed, but there is clear from the archaeological evidence that there was a mounted aristocracy in Latium, the central region of Italy, at this period. And then as the equites became their own order, their own constituent part of the Roman state, traditions were invented to explain their role at the beginning of the Roman state. So the origin of the equites was seen in the units of Romulus, the founder and first king of Rome, who founded the Celeres, the swift ones. So it's thought the origin of the equites was in Romulus's own personal cavalry. After that, in the Republican period, the Roman state developed a structure which we call the Comitia Centuriata, a wealth-based voting assembly. And this determined the order in which Roman citizens got to vote to pass legislation, declare peace and war, elect consuls, for example. And in the Comitia Centuriata, there were 18 centuries, so 18 groups of 100 people, devoted to the equites. So these were aristocrats who were able to serve on horseback, and they constituted the cavalry of the Roman state, as opposed to the pedetes, the infantrymen. But Rome also instituted a special privilege for these 1,800 equites. They were given the horse by the state itself. This is what we call the equus publicus, the public horse. And this was funded by a tax on unmarried women and orphans.
You're taxing people for being orphans in order to give rich people horses?
Funds for the state. So Livy tells us, for the purchase of horses, they were allowed 10,000 asses each from the state treasury, and for the maintenance of these horses, unmarried women were designated who had to pay 2,000 asses each every year. So I think the idea is it's coming back to the idea of encouraging people to marry. If a woman is unmarried, she's not performing a positive role for the state in giving birth to more Roman citizens.
So how does it go from a military-style role into an aristocracy?
Well, originally, we only have these 1,800 equites on horseback, and then the cavalry expands to take in equites who are serving on their own horses, so not subsidized by the public funds. But over the course of the Roman Republic, Rome starts to rely on its allies for cavalry rather than coming from within the Roman state itself. People like the Spanish horsemen, for example, or horsemen from Campania. And what this means is the equites by the 2nd century BC are really only serving as officers rather than the actual cavalrymen themselves. And this is probably because there are other status designations for which they can compete in this period. So as Rome expands throughout the Mediterranean, more wealth flows into Rome. So people want to build wonderful houses to show off, write histories and speeches like the Greeks to show off. There are different ways in which they can display their status instead of serving in the army. And many of them are also working as publicani or contractors for the Roman state, many of whom are in charge of collecting the taxes. And this was a very lucrative business. So the Roman state outsourced this tax collection in the provinces. So the publicani would bid for how much they were going to get from their tax collection to the censors. Mm. And the censors would then let it out to the highest bidder. Then they would go off to the province and they could collect that much, but they could also collect as much as they want. So they could take more than they had promised the state and they got to keep that themselves.
They get the surplus.
Yeah, they could get the surplus. So yeah. It was incredibly lucrative business. Mm. And they could also be involved in commerce. So senators were actually forbidden from engaging in business and commerce, apart from agriculture, because agriculture and maintenance of your state was seen as a proper senatorial thing to do. So this was an area in which equites could come in to their own that way.
So at what point did the equites develop into their own equestrian order?
So this happened towards the end of the 2nd century BC, and this happened for two reasons. Firstly, in 129 BC, a law was passed to say that you could not be an equestrian and a senator at the same time.
Right.
So if you were going to enter the Senate, you had to surrender your public horse before taking up membership of that body. So this separated senators from the equites completely. We have a nice account from Plutarch in his biography of Pompey, which talks about when Pompey had to surrender his horse to enter the Senate. So this is from Plutarch, Pompey 22. "It is customary for a Roman equestrian, when he had served the time fixed by law, to lead his horse into the forum before the two men who are called censors. And after enumerating all the generals and imperators upon under whom he had served, and rendering an account of his service in the field to reserve his discharge. At this time, then, the censors Gellius and Lentulus were sitting in state, and the equestrians were passing in review before them, when Pompey was seen coming down the descent into the forum, but leading his horse with his own hand. When he was near and could be plainly seen, he ordered his lictors to make way for him and led his horse up to the tribunal. The people were astonished and kept perfect silence, and the magistrates were awed and delighted at the sight. The senior censor put the question, 'Pompeius, I ask thee whether you have performed all the military services required by law.' Then Pompey said with a loud voice, 'I have performed them all, and all under myself as imperator.'" So this obviously played on the idea that Pompey had an extremely unorthodox senatorial career and was given commands before even being a member of the Senate. But once he entered it, he had to surrender his public horse to show that he was transitioning from the equestrian order into the Senate.
It kind of also insinuates that he thinks that being an equestrian is way beyond what he is at the time.
Well, yes, it's exactly. The other change in the 2nd century BC occurred in the tribunate of Gaius Gracchus, who people might remember as one of the two great reforming tribunes.
I was about to say one of the two ill-fated Gracchus brothers.
Yes, certainly, yes. So Tiberius in 133 BC and then Gaius Gracchus in 123 and 122 BC. And he passed laws on a court on provincial extortion. So Roman senatorial governors had become very rapacious in the provinces and had been extorting the provincials. And so there was an extortion court set up in Rome, but it was notoriously corrupt because the senators were tried by their senatorial peers. Gaius Gracchus gave the power to sit on the juries of these courts to equites instead, which then gave them political power over the senators. And so this gave birth to a class consciousness amongst the equestrian order. They were a group set apart from the Senate.
And they've got to keep the senators honest, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And over the next 50 years or so, the extortion courts and other courts which are set up become a political football between the Senate and the equites. So some tribunes and politicians transfer them to the senators, but then someone else transfers them back to the equites. And Cicero, the famous Roman orator and lawyer, He is from an equestrian family himself, though he rises to the Senate, and he really plays up to the equestrian class in his speeches. As he's working his way up through the cursus honorum, he depends on the support of the equites to elect him to magistrates. So when he stands up in 70 BC as a prosecutor in the case of Gaius Verres, the notoriously corrupt governor of Sicily, he stands before a senatorial jury. But he tells them that their predecessors as senators, as jurors, have been corrupt, and they need to be upright and just like the equites when they were sat on the jury. And he says in his Verres narrations, "Over the past 10 years, since the juries have been handed over to the Senate, cases have been decided in a disgraceful and heinous manner. Members of the jury, the Roman people will learn from me why, when the equestrian order sat in judgment for nearly 50 straight years, there was never the slightest inkling that an equestrian serving as juror had accepted a bribe to influence his decision. They will learn why, when the courts were transferred to the senatorial order, and the power of the Roman people over every man was removed, that Quintus Calidus said that an ex-praetor would not be found guilty for less than 300,000 sesterces." He's drawing a contrast, which is exaggerated, because there could be corrupt equestrian juries, but he's saying, you know, when they sat, you know, no one accepted bribes, but nowadays, you know, people can be acquitted, you know, for 300,000 sesterces.
Which is a pretty hefty price tag.
It's a really, if you know, you had that much money, you know, you want to try and get acquitted. But this shows how much Cicero relied on the equestrian order for their support. And after the Verres narration, courts are split, so they're made up of a third senators, a third equestrians, and a third of another group called the Tribuni Aerarii, who are probably also equestrians. So the majority of jurors are equites, and Cicero really appeals to that. So when, for example, the son of a publicanus, one of these contractors, is being put on trial, he goes at length about how the equites and the publicani are great men, and he calls the publicani the flower of the equestrian order. So this is why Pliny the Elder, who was himself an equestrian, in his Natural History, talks about the key role Cicero played in the formation of the equestrian order.
Over the history of the Roman Empire, then, this is a role that has changed quite a lot. So what can we point to as far as legislation changes go? Do we have any documentation on those sort of things?
The reign of Augustus is a key turning point in the history of the equestrian order, because he tries to recreate the res publica, the Roman state, as a group of people who support his position as the sole leader, the princeps of Rome. So he's keen to mark out the senatorial order and their aristocracy. To be a member of the Senate, you need to have property worth 1 million sesterces. And he also introduces social legislation to ensure that the senatorial order, the young men will marry and have children. And the equites are set at a group having 400,000 sesterces that are men of good birth, so they're citizens, also a fine moral character. But he also gives them a role in the state in ceremonies which he revives, such as the Transvectio Equitum, the annual parade through the city of Rome, in which they all get dressed up in their military gear and march through the Forum past the temple of the Castores, of Castor and Pollux, who are the patron deities of the equites. They also are associated with the imperial house, because Augustus's adopted sons, Gaius and Lucius Caesar, are given the title each of princeps juventutus, the leader of the youth, and therefore of the equestrian order, who are supposed to symbolize the military reserves of the state. And the heirs, Gaius and Lucius, get given ceremonial palmae and hastae, the shields and spears of the equestrian order. We can see this ideology in action and the poetry of Ovid, who was himself a member of the Equestrian Order, but then was exiled. And he talks about, in his Tristia, the celebrations of everyone for Tiberius's triumph. And he says, the loyal people celebrates, together with the loyal people, the Senate and the Equestrian Order, of which I was until recently a small part. There's this idea in the Augustan period that all constituent groups of the Res Publica, the Senate, the Equites, and the people, they all support this new institution of monarchy.
Mm.
And Augustus was also keen to restore morality in the Equestrian Order, as he was with the Senatorial Order. And he is said to have personally often reviewed the Equestrian squadrons. According to Suetonius, Augustus would not permit anyone riding in the parade to be forced off his horse by an accuser, which used to happen. So he could say, you know, you're too fat, you know, you've been sleeping with prostitutes or something, you shouldn't be in there. Augustus also allowed, I'm quoting Suetonius, also allowed those who are marked out by their old age or frailty to send their horses on ahead in the line. But they had to approach by foot when they were called upon to respond. Later, he granted a favour to those men who were more than 35 years old and did not wish to retain their public horse, the right of returning them. If you were one of the seniores, the older men in the order.
So it sounds like it's still quite an active role in that time.
Yes, I mean, Augustus is playing a key role. Later on in the Julio-Claudian Flavian periods, the parade continued, but there were many more equites who lived in the provinces. So they didn't come to Rome all the time, and you could probably get equestrian status by making an application to the emperor or by having a patron intercede with you.
Yeah.
So it's probable that over the course of the Augustan period, the number of equites rose to about 20,000, up from about 5,000 in the Republic, and then perhaps as many as 30,000 to 40,000 afterwards in the imperial period. So it's a group that was designed to include the local elites of the provinces in an imperial aristocracy.
So what evidence is there of people rising up from the lower ranks into the equites once they fulfil the criteria?
Yes. So we have some wonderful inscriptions which trace the rise of individual families. They may start as clerks, public servants, and then over several generations rise into the equestrian and the senatorial order. For example, the family of Marius Maximus, a prominent senator in the Severan period, they rose from being one of the apparitores, the public servants. His grandfather was a clerk, his father was an equestrian procurator, and he entered the Senate. And we can trace this rise over several generations through inscriptions.
Mm.
We also have a rather nice graffito from Pompeii, which records the rise of an individual called Gaius Hadius Ventrio, which is scrawled onto the wall of one of the houses. And it says, Gaius Hadius Ventrio, an equus Romanus, a Roman equestrian, was born amongst the beets and cabbage. So, you know, he was born here, humble beginnings. He's now risen up and become an equestrian.
Mm.
It's interesting, Ventrio, Mr. Belly, so maybe he was, living off the rewards of his...
as in stomach belly.
Stomach belly, yes, yeah. Yes, you know, he had quite a big belly there. But also, there were people who could fall on hard times as well if they didn't have the 400,000 sesterces. So one of the status symbols of the equestrian order was the gold ring. People could see just on your hand if you were an equus. But if you lost your fortune, you lost your ring and everyone would know about it. So the satirist Juvenal writes about the downfall of people. In his 11th satire, there's an anecdote about an equus called Pollio. Juvenal says, his ring disappears and Pollio now begs with his unadorned hand.
Oh.
So it's all gone. And Horace, again, another equestrian, talks about what happens if you want to be an equestrian but you don't quite have the money. You possess a good head, the right character, eloquence and honour. But if you're a few thousand short of 400,000 sesterces, you'll be one of the masses.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, you could be almost there, but if you don't have that, you're just one of the plebs.
Mm.
And this is really important because being an equestrian was seen as something that was achievable. It's a bit like the proverbial $1 million of the American dream. People thought that one day that could be them, even though it probably won't be. But senatorial status was seen as, you know, something far reserved. There was only about 600 of them. But people looked at the wealthy businessmen, tax collectors with their gold rings and thought, ah, one day that'll be me if only I do well enough.
And it sounds like it would have been a trusted kind of rank as well, that these are people who can fulfill certain roles in society that you wouldn't necessarily want to give to the senatorial rank. You'd want to know that these are people who can manage their money.
Yes.
These would become trusted men in Rome, wouldn't they?
Very much so.
I don't want to compare it quite this way, but I kind of see it as a little bit of a bureaucratic layer in Rome. And also, are you familiar with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yes.
Okay. This is Arc B. This is the phone sanitizers and the marketing managers.
Yeah, so under Augustus, they really start to take on the role of administrators. And this is because Augustus wants to involve as many wealthy people in the administration of the state as possible. In the Republican period, you basically had to be a senator to go and govern the provinces. But now, under Augustus, we start to get equestrian governors of provinces. And over the first two centuries of the empire, a new bureaucratic structure develops with status grades so that equestrians can rise up in the imperial service in the same way as senators. They can be in charge of the grain supply in Rome. They could be prefect of Egypt. They could be the Praetorian prefect, commander of the emperor's bodyguard. They could be his ab epistulis, his correspondence secretary, like Suetonius, the famous biographer. Now, this only happens gradually. The career structure isn't born fully formed under Augustus, but it does evolve. By the Severan period, there's 300 really important jobs they can do in the administration. They also serve as officers in the Roman army as well. So tribunes of the legions, auxiliary cohorts can be equestrians. And this gives people from the provinces a whole range of roles which they can fulfill. And they don't have to have a career. They could go off and serve once as prefect of a cavalry unit and then return to their hometown and erect a wonderful inscription with a statue that says, I've served the emperor as a cavalry commander. And they have done that for 3 years, but it brings them increased status and prestige. Mm. So it's definitely, yes, a group that is respected that you can look up to.
You mentioned a ring, but what were the status symbols that you'd get or that you'd be able to display as a member of the equestrian order?
So you had the gold ring. You also had your tunic with a narrow stripe. So senators had the tunic with the latus clavus, the broad purple stripe. Equites had the angustus clavus, the narrow purple stripe. Mm. They were also given the privilege of sitting in the first 14 rows of the theatre. In Rome and theoretically in the provinces, they didn't quite operate that because there weren't as many equites and provincial towns as in Rome. And that was also extended to the circus and the amphitheatre. So in the theatre, the senators would sit in the orchestra right at the front, and then behind them would be the equites all arrayed together.
Yeah.
And since the equites didn't have a meeting place like the Senate House for the senators, very often they use the theatre to express their collective will, such as shouts of approval in favour of the emperor and his family, or choruses of disapproval if they didn't like what the emperor had done. For example, the reign of Tiberius banned equestrians from cavorting with pantomimes, and the equites loved pantomimes, so they staged a protest, and there were theatre riots. So the idea was the equites were supposed to be seen sitting in the 14 rows of the theatre, which meant that they weren't supposed to act, dance, or in the amphitheatre fight as a gladiator, because that was seen as immoral and it was seen to be reducing themselves to the lowest of the low.
Yeah, yeah.
Equites often wanted to fight in the arena because to display their martial virtus, their skill, but they were not supposed to do it for money, to subordinate themselves to a lanista, a gladiatorial trainer. But sometimes they had to when they fell on hard times, for example. In the first century AD, we find lots of social legislation which continually reinforces the ban on equestrians fighting in the arena.
Yeah, that sounds like an instance that has come up because some of them are doing it.
Yeah, exactly. It's continually reinforced. And of course, when you have young emperors like Caligula and Nero, especially Nero, who wants to get involved in this sort of thing, it sets a bad example, which then later emperors have to try and rein in as
Yeah. So what happens to the equites in the late Roman Empire then?
There's a couple of stages. The first happens in the 3rd century AD when you have men who have worked their way up from the ranks of the army promoted to equestrian officer posts without having been equestrians first. So essentially they get equestrian status as a reward for working themselves way up for the army. It's not a precondition for the post in the first place.
Yeah.
And several of these men then go on to become Roman emperors, because in the 3rd century, whoever is control of an army and is a great general can be emperor. So we get emperors such as Aurelian and Probus and Diocletian, who owe their social mobility to working their way up through the army. What eventually happens under the Constantinian emperors is that the numbers of senators are increased. So for the first time, you have more than 600 senators, and then you have a senate at Constantinople as well as at Rome. And what this means is that the top equites then actually become senators, and the ranks of the senators expand, and there are more status grades within the senatorial order. So equites still exist, but they're not the prestigious governors or generals, administrators of before. They tend to be lower ranked scribes in the imperial administration, for example.
Okay.
So it still exists as a status designation because it's a recognisable honour, which is associated with the Roman state, but it's not as prestigious as it once was. So essentially, most equites become senators, and the senators expand. And what this means, they need to introduce new grades within the Senate. So you get people like viri illustres or spectabiles, and a whole new rank of senatorial titles are invented. But it doesn't really change the structure of the Roman state in that aristocrats are always ordered into hierarchical groups. And that's because aristocrats need to feel that they're better than the people, as well as other aristocrats as well.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and author of A History of the Roman Equestrian Order, published by Cambridge University Press. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Leave a review there. It'll help other people find our work. It'll help other people find this podcast. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport. I am at Nightlight Guy. And the show is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll be celebrating Valentine's Day just a little bit early. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.